All right, so I'm gonna get started. I was working in Michael Elowitz's group, working on sigma factors, which are transcription factors that recruit different types of sort of networks that are involved in different functions in the cell. And in Bacillus, there's, I think, 17 of them. And so one of the things that Michael has found is that under certain environmental conditions, these sigma factors can be activated in pulses. So rather than being sort of continually expressed, they come in sort of pulses, and they seem to be non-overlapping with one another. One of the hypotheses is that these sigma factors are all competing with one another for RNA polymerase, which they bind to and then recruit the polymerase to promoters of different genes that they activate. So in order to try to get at this hypothesis of whether or not these sigma factors are competing, I was interested in working with some lines that have knockouts of different sigma factors. So if these things are competing for polymerase, then knocking out one of the sigma factors should free up additional polymerase for the other ones to be active. And initially, I wanted to do this with sort of time-lapse microscopy so I could actually observe pulsing dynamics of the different sigma factors that are under a reporter. Unfortunately, I didn't have much success with that due to technical problems with the microscopy. So I did observe some pulsing, but not the kind I wanted to. So this is my microscope just oscillating in and out of focus, which turned out to be because of fluctuations in the temperature of the incubator in the machine. So it was really sensitive to these really small changes of flushing in hot air when it got too cool. In the absence of that, I did the best I could to gather data through other mechanisms. So one of the things I did was just looked at the growth rates using a microplate reader. So the legend that you see up in the top left there is showing the different knockouts of different sigma factors, B, D, L, M. And so this is what the growth data looks like. Pretty clean and pretty consistent between trials. And so what I did was fit in some lines during this exponential phase, which is shown in this little inlet here. And you can see that it's pretty well linear on a log scale here. So I got pretty nice fits. And one of the things that sort of jumps out is that delta D seems to grow faster. Like the slope of that line is bigger. And you can see that.
The wild type?
So the wild type, yeah, sorry. The wild type is these starred asterisk guys. And I'm just showing the min and max and those sort of dotted red lines around that. So what I did actually was I put the control in like a checkerboard design across the whole plate so that I could see any sort of variation across the plate. And so you can see that sort of, while there is some there was some plate effect, nothing in the control was wildly different compared to what we see in like delta D, for example.
Chris, are the horizontal offsets between the curves meaningful in any way?
So I think that probably depends a lot on both the growth rate and the inoculum size, which probably vary between different cultures that I use. So I don't think that the vertical offset is necessarily that informative compared to the slope.
Although you grew them for the same period before putting them into the plate reader?
Yeah, I grew them for the same period and diluted them by the same amount. But there, there might be some variation. What delta D is actually involved in making flagellum. There's sort of two hypotheses. One is that delta D hogs up a lot of polymerase making flagellum, and if you get rid of it in a well-shaken culture, you can grow a lot faster. Another is just that the flagellum may be really costly, and so getting rid of production of flagellum might also be beneficial. This is just showing the doubling time of the different strains. So the control is on the left there, and then the stars are the min and max doubling time that we're observed. And you can see that delta D is just sort of has a way shorter doubling time than any of the the other guys. And yeah, so the error bars are just the standard error of the mean because they have these three replicates and estimated the growth rate in each. So the other thing that I did was measure the fluorescence distribution of some of these guys on the facts. So I didn't have much time to really delve into that data. But what I did find is that in some of these knockouts, they're really shifted towards more cells being fluorescently activated. So what I did was on the facts, I ran a control that had no YFP, no fluorescence signature, and I subtracted off or basically excluded any data that fell within the range of that sort of autofluorescent control. And so on the very left, this is YFPW, so this is just the marker with no knockouts, and then I have all the knockouts here. And you can see that that in a lot of these cases, there's sort of more cells that seem to be fluorescing in these knockout lines.
The YFP is the reporter for SIGW.
Yeah, so sorry. All of these data that I've been looking at have a reporter for one of the sigma factors, which is sigma W. So I'm just looking at the sort of activity of sigma W under these backgrounds.
And sigma W knockouts. Is what? Housekeeping?
I don't know exactly what sigma W is. It was just the only one that we had the full.
It's one of the stress response and anabolic response.
And so I should say that all these data that you're looking at least for the facts, are under conditions where they were exposed to a drug that activates all pulsing in all of these different sigma factors. So so since all these sigma factors should be pulsing, these guys that are sort of fluorescing above the background level are presumably guys that were sort of pulsing when they went through the flow cytometer. So that, yeah.
So how do we interpret this?
Yeah.
You take out B and there's more.
Right.
Or W to work.
Exactly. So you take out D and W pulses more frequently, and so you see more cells.
What's the half life of YFP?
Not sure.
It's a bit stable.
Yeah. Right. So how does that fit with the pulse?
Maybe you should say, how do you get the fluorescent fraction? Presumably you look at histogram of YFP levels across cells, and then you have a threshold or something?
Yeah, so I set the threshold as basically anything that was above the maximum fluorescence observed in the sort of autofluorescence control. So anything that was fluorescing sort of above that background level ratio. So that's sort of an arbitrary cutoff, but I played around with different sort of going within two standard deviations of the mean and that control, and it didn't really have any effects on the qualitative result.
And do you think the L result? I mean, the L is obviously the exception here.
Yeah. Maybe L isn't that big of a factor in terms of competition with the other sigma factors.
But that was the one that had the biggest breast effect on it.
Actually, D had the biggest
breast effect. Okay.
So what set of genes does L regulate?
I don't know. Do you guys know?
I wanted to ask, what was the media?
So, amino acid metabolism.
What media did you use to burn them?
This is in a minimal media in the presence of a drug that should activate pulsing in all of these.
This is 48 micrograms.
Yep.
So, amino acid metabolism, building amino acids, I presume, not degrading.
So, maybe one has to ask the question of what's the differential between, say, B and L? So what does delta B?
Well, B is the general stress response, so that's kind of like the best studied thing. But I think the key question here is when we,
well, how about delta X?
X, we think, responds to some antibiotics and maybe
some antibiotics.
Yeah. Like acetracin and stuff, which we'll hear more about. But I guess the assumption here is that when it goes up, it's because of competition. You're relieving competition by relieving the sigma factors.
Right. And I don't know that we can say anything about, this specific model of time sharing. It could be other modes of like concentration sharing and polymerase or something like that. But there does seem to be some effect on these backgrounds with these knockouts of greater fluorescence activity. So that was all the data slides that I had to show.
I think it's worth saying that this is actually is surprising. I mean, it's not surprising, but it's interesting because, in fact, it's not obvious that deleting a single sigma factor in most cases will relieve competition enough to have a big effect on the activities of other sigma factors.
Right.
These are big effects.
Yeah.
So I think this is actually very striking.
Yeah.
In my opinion. And then,
but presumably you would want also to see the control, which actually tells you that the delta L is not delta, excuse me, sigma L
is actually
induced by this condition just as much as sigma X.
Rich, I was wondering, so L controls amino acid metabolism, is that right?
That's correct.
So how do you, so you would think that in a minimal media that would be high and needed, but of course it's missing there, which means...
It's not generally switched on, actually.
But in minimal media?
In minimal media. At least I've got some data, so that's right. Just kind of at the same level as the control.
But in minimal medium, it's got to make all its amino acids.
I think some of the amino acids control some particular thing, maybe, because we do give them, we give them tryptophan, which I guess they might be able to compare. Well, it's just a couple of other amino acids.
And then they may metabolize. Do they grow on tryptophan as a carbon and nitrogen source?
This is for isoleucine, leucine, valine, and in particular, these are for signaling. There's a lot of signaling of metabolism that goes through them.
Right.
There's a major regulator in bacillus called CODY, which responds to these regulators. So it has other role.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So with the drug MPA, which is an energy stress that activates all the seven sigma factors. Six of them are pulsing, and the response to the stress is mainly by increasing the pulse frequency. So you see that the duration of the pulse remains more or less constant, and the amplitude varies a bit, but slightly. So what I wanted to see, so there is this other drug called basotracin, without the name, sorry, that targets the cell wall, and that is known to activate only two sigma factors, sigma X and sigma M. So I thought this would be interesting to do because we have the double label strain so that you can monitor both the activities of these two sigma factors at the same time. So what I did is I did a first experiment where I grow the cell. I put them for 1 hour in basic tracing at different concentration. And then after this hour, I take snapshots of this cell. So for I can have the distribution of the fluorescence of both markers for each, so for without drug and with all the different concentration of drug. So without drug, you see we have kind of the background distribution. So you can, so here you see there is one outliner. So, but you can still see that all of them are not activated, and here maybe this one is activated, I don't know why. If you go to the other distribution with drug, you can keep this threshold and say that maybe this is still background fluorescence and this is still activation. So this is only the distribution, and this is the fluorescence. So this is for the sig X. Yeah, so you've got the fluorescence and the number of cells that express this target. So if you do this, you can, so by counting the number of these cells that are above this threshold, you can get a sub-distribution. You can calculate the mean amplitude of this activated cells. So you see that the amplitude keeps being constant for sig X, but you have a slight increase of the amplitude for sig M. And also, if you count the number of the cells that are activated, you still see that when you increase the drug concentration, the frequency increases. Okay, as you have also the two markers in the same cell, you can look at the correlation between the activation. So here, this line corresponds to the threshold. So here you've got all the background fluorescence, so you don't really care. So here you see that you can have sig X activated without sig M being activated. But it seems, if you take into account these 5 points, that as long, so if sig M is activated, you also have sig X activated. So here I have very few points, so I did a larger range of antibiotic concentration to get a bit more data in this area.
So
the color is the concentration. Yeah. So now I did exactly the same experiment with 500, 1,000, and 1,500. So here you still see this correlation between the expression of the sigma factor. So at first you can, so either there is really a correlation, so they may be pulsing at the same time, but what I want to emphasize is the fact that we, so it's still with this fluorescent proteins that are stable. So here, as I have only snapshots, they can be pulsing really fast. Not exactly at the same time, but the fact that the protein is stable smoothens my signal more or less. So the conclusion of all this is that you can get, if you get to sufficiently high concentration, you can get the sigma factor to really compete. But you need to have really the information about the time sharing theory.
How do you see this as evidence for competition? It seems like
You manage to increase the activation of them at the same time. So here you may, something will, they will have to share the time. Like they both of them will want to increase their frequency.
But so if they were competing, wouldn't you expect like an L-shaped distribution on the previous?
If they were competing with the time sharing?
With each other, yeah.
Yeah. What I just say here is that I don't have the resolution to maybe have this L-shaped curve, but there seem to be, they enter in a regime where both of them are activated and want to respond by increasing their frequency. So if you have the time information, something may, you may see something.
More or less.
Yeah.
How long were they?
1 hour, I
think. So it seems like, yeah. It seems like an hour, the pulse is about an hour long, right?
We don't know. With this drug, we don't know.
Yeah. But it seems like you didn't get M switched on without X also on.
Yeah, but so maybe just, right. It may just mean that X is switched on and then right after M is switched on. But we don't have the big, the temporal accuracy to distinguish them.
But then we thought that this saturation-like curvature you might interpret as
sigma M muscle suppressing sigma X. So the beating, M beating X in the competition.
Because of this frequent?
Well, I mean, because of
well, I wouldn't go that far, but maybe. No, I agree, there may be something, but honestly, I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
It could be the concern tomorrow in practice and have it switch on one.
Yeah.
So here you're essentially integrating off the for the whole community theory of the set, right? So
yeah.
Because now, an hour is the degradation time on the.
No, I think it's.
Okay.
But then measured. So they get the drug for an hour.
Yeah. And then they are measured right after by taking snapshots.
I mean, another interpretation which we could explore is the idea that the drug is inducing M and X, and which are both able to turn on significantly, but which compete down all the other ones that you're not looking at in the picture, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that you're not in a competitive group, but it may mean that M and X are both able to significantly activate. Yeah, and then the question is, what happens with the other one?
Yeah, actually, it would be really interesting to check if really the other one are not doing anything.
Yeah.
But that's more or less what's documented is that they will act, like this drug will activate those two signals.
Right. But I mean, the nice thing is we could take another strain from the matrix with like X and some other one and see if
what happened to this
more
other,
of a
competitive
distribution. Yeah.
Sure. So yeah, so the conclusion was that just to get this better time resolution, you would need a time lapse that I tried to do and failed miserably to do. but yeah, the interesting idea was that so they both want to increase the frequency of pulsing. So at some point, if they still want to, they will have either to overlap, and then if they overlap, they'll have to share the polymerase, so decrease the amplitude of the pulses, or they'll have to shorten the pulse duration, which may be a problem because it seems to be controlled by this pathway of sigma into sigma and the anti-sigma. So yeah, maybe to get one of these regimes would be really nice.
But I would just add the third possibility, which is that they're both actually not competing with each other, but competing with
some
other ones.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this all this was assuming that like you only have these two, and if you only have these two, I think it's very interesting because you can monitor everything that's happening at the same time. So it would be really nice. Okay.
Okay, so I was doing a kind of similar experiment to Marie, except I was stressing the cells with lysozyme, which also affects their cell wall, and I was just looking at the response of one sigma factor, sigma V, because there was some evidence or some suspicions that perhaps sigma V does a kind of different dynamics. It might not pulse, but it might have some sort of bimodality or bistability. So the experiment was, I just grew some overnights of the strain that has the fluorescent marker for this, and plated them on these little pads, seven of them with increasing lysozyme concentration, waited a few hours, and then tried to do a time-lapse movie. And the idea was that maybe we could see something like this, like some switching or some bistability in the expression in individual cells. That as many other people have already said, kind of didn't quite work out as well as it could have. So this is the RFP guide. This is just some measure, I guess, of which guides are alive, which guides are dead. And this one is the thing that some market for Sigma V. So here's just a little movie of the thing. The problem is the thing moves. But if I pause this guy about here, and I play this one. Okay, so these are roughly at the same time now. And you see that, so these guys, if you look at this, these guys are kind of all on here. And you look at the equivalent image that's telling you something about which guys are expressing sigma V or not, and you do clearly see that some ones are just not turned on, and other ones are. And there is some spatial correlation with these things, which I think is some evidence that if they are switching between on and off, they're probably not doing so that quickly. Otherwise, you might expect a more checkerboardy pattern. Yeah.
Is this still this non-degradable?
Yes. So it's the cumulative of everything in the history here.
So. Right. So if there is a clear spatial correlation just because they come from the same antibody matter.
Yeah. So yeah, it's certainly not ideal. But if you just look at just taking some stills, so this was a zero concentration. And this is RFP. You then look at YFP. Nothing's there. There's no stress response. You go to kind of intermediate things. This is a still from the movie I just showed you, and clearly, you do see this kind of some guys on, some guys off. But then when you go to really high concentrations, and you do the same thing, it looks like basically they just all stay on. So if you try and quantify this, this is quantifying it looking at about 30 cells. So, I mean, in principle, we could have like looked at all the cells in the movie and got better statistics, but this was actually just the first frame of all the movies I made. So the number of cells analyzed is really small. This is kind of the concentration of lysozyme, so this was the control, down to 5 was the most we did. This is the RFP, so it's just telling you some which guys are alive. And you do see some reasonable evidence, I think. So here, like, you know, everything is off, there's no stress. And as you move down, things begin to turn on. In the intermediate things, I guess there's some very weak evidence of some bystandery, like, you know, this guy is bigger, these guys are a bit bigger out here. But, you know, from the movies, I think it's slightly more believable than there's some bystandery. But then as you go really far down, it looks like just probably everything just turns on. So the shape of how this evolves, I think, would be quite an interesting thing to actually get good statistics on, and actually do the time, you know, how it evolves in time as well. But that's basically where I got to at like 1 a.m. last night.
So you would say that pulsing is in this intermediate regime?
I don't know if they pulse. So this is this is just looking at static distribution of.
Well, right, so presumably if they are all on the static snapshot, unless you're very lucky to get everybody in the same phase, they call it a pulse.
Right. Yeah. But so in they could be doing some sort of on-off thing in the middle here.
You need the differential. You need to know, like, you need to do what they do in the original one, which is to look at the time differential. And then it might be that someone expressed and then stopped expressing. So if this guy turns on, like all the time, high concentration of lysozyme, that's a good candidate to deplete polymerase if you want to do this competition.
Maybe, I don't know what the level of
four
is.
At a high concentration, and you put another stress, right, an antibiotic or something, and you know this is going to be all gone, and the other one is
I think I'd say two things to that. First, we had other. I think that's a good point. In addition, I would point out that the 5 is not all. They're not all on. At the highest concentration. Which I think is actually interesting.
But from the movies, they kind of are. This is only from the first frame. You get better statistics here, right? This is like a bit later on.
Okay.
Right? I would argue that there's very little evidence for much.
No, but
okay, there is here, right? Yeah.
That one. I guess I would ask one other question, which is, as you just looked at the movies by eye with no quantum, you know, no tracking or anything, did you ever just see an event where a cell turned on or a cell sort of clearly turned from off to on, like where you could suddenly see it low and then start to get brighter or vice versa?
Don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, we could try and check now if you
want. And what is the interest the other way around, isn't it? I mean, so they're off to begin with, obviously, and then they turn on. What about the possibility that it's just a, you know, a rather imprecise switching on event, so that they just, by the time you get up enough.
I think I can't rule that out here, but I think it would be easy to rule out by just getting that sort of better data.
Yeah, but I mean, one question is like, that's the big question here. What are the dynamics? It's very interesting, actually. You can get such a nice dynamic range.
Sure.
With this drug.
If you did the experiment, we saw yesterday, we just like played with different concentrations of stuff, right? Remember Roy's experiment?
I wasn't here anymore.
So you put like lanes with increasing concentration of your stress. And
and see which guys can climb up.
You force them to grow. You should see them like not closing and then closing and then.
That'll be fun. So it's not. It's the difference from release thing is that the lysozyme is not necessarily an antibiotic. I think that's as far as I know. But the point is, they could. You still could witness, like, use the spatial thing to kind of see the difference in dynamics. That would be fun, actually. What we need is the orange plate with single cell resolution.
I guess.
You know, we use that gigantic computer. I think all the world would be the observatory.
Okay, so this is going to be yet another stress that we... This is something I only literally did in the last 3 days because we only thought about it carefully on about Wednesday. So one of the things that we're interested in is if you were to deplete the amount of available polymerase in some way, what would the effect of this be on the pulsing, like the frequency and the amplitude? Now, obviously, time-lapse would be wonderful, but we'll show you the nice movie in a while that's nothing to do with this. But we did eventually get some actual movies running. However, access to microscopes was not universal. So this is going to be an experiment in which I analyze stills of cells exposed to something. So what I did was I suggested at some point that it'd be interesting to see whether the growth rate of the strain would affect the length of the pulses and so on and so on. And then when we had a conversation with Joel, who was looking at the model for this system, he was saying what he found from the model if you suppress the number of polymerases or increase the number of polymerases. So then we decided it'd actually be interesting to see if we could titrate out polymerase effectively by exposing the cells to rifampicin, which should generally make polymerase activity worse. So what I did was take the different reporter strains here, SIGB, D, L, M, W, X, and Y, and the wild type, and I did just a serial dilution of rifampicin concentrations, and then I exposed them on the black line, it's just rifampicin. The red line, which you can barely see, is with the addition of 20 micrograms per mil of this MPA, which is supposed to activate all of the different sigma factors, and the green line is 14 micrograms per mil. So first thing to notice is that MPA really, really does actually cripple the cells. This is the optical density after 24 hours shaking at 37, and so cells are not terribly happy. I mean, one of the time lapses we did try, for instance, we put 40 micrograms per mil of MPA on the pad and nothing grew at all. So we're not sure why that is, because the original experiments used 40. So The only interesting thing about this graph, I guess, is that the SIGB and SIGD strains seem to be less resistant to rifampicin for whatever reason. I don't know why that is.
This is a deletion. Oh.
No, this is just the reporter strain. So this might be because it's being activated and somehow that's making life more difficult for them.
What you expected to see there, or what would you?
I didn't know how much rifampicin to use. Mm-hmm. I've had time, I've done the MIC curves completely separately, figured out how much rifampicin to use, and then done the exposure. But I had time to do one thing, so I just crammed it all into one experiment, where I did both the exposure and the MPA exposure in the same setup.
So the green line again is?
Is 40 micrograms per mil of MPA.
The light green line is.
Yeah, so.
This one is 40.
This is 40, this is 20, this is no MPA. And rifampicin goes from 8 micrograms per mil all the way down to 1 over 128 micrograms per mil, which is not very much, but apparently Bacillus is quite sensitive to rifampicin.
Yeah, so again, Michael, what's your expectation here?
I didn't really have an expectation. I had no idea how much rifampicin to use. Oh, okay. So this was just a way of me figuring out how much rifampicin to use, and also to figure out whether the MPA condition, whether exposing them to MPA was actually slowing their growth terribly. And so the most right-hand points in each case is no rifampicin at all, so just MPA. And you can still see that it's really, really, they're struggling to grow in this, which was something that we've been having problems with. So.
And these are all the same except for where the reporter gene is.
Yeah, exactly. Just different reporters and the control, which doesn't have a reporter.
And the first thing you said was effectively that the blue lines crash or they move from the right sooner.
Two of the strains seem to be more sensitive as a result of having this reporter. I don't know why that is. It's possible that they're being activated strongly, and therefore the extra pressure of expressing is making it more difficult to survive. It's possible that there's some other genetic difference that we're not aware of as well. From the transformation process, they could have picked up something strange.
I mean, it's also possible it's just replicate somehow.
Yeah, this obviously doesn't have replicates either. Yeah, please excuse that as well. So what I did then was I plated out a small amount of each of these types of strains. So for each report strain, I took a well in which they had actually grown, put them onto an agar patch, and just had a look to see what they were doing in the red and yellow channels. So the control there on the left is, this is like the background fluorescence of basically nothing. And I put a red line in to show you two standard deviations above the mean, which I just chose as a cutoff. I could have chosen the maximum, but it's very little difference. This way, there's more lines on the graphs. So you can see that SIGB is activated. These are all from the case with no MPA, so just rifampicin. Because I needed to know which sigma factors rifampicin activated, because there was no point in looking at the ones where rifampicin was confusing things. So SIGB is switched on, SIGD is switched on, SIGL is around the control level, SIGM is around the control level, maybe switched on slightly. SIGW displays really, really strong bimodality under rifampicin. Like, I'll show you a picture in a second. It's incredibly strong. They're either massively on or massively off. SIGX just switches on so far that you can't even see the red line. It's on the left. So SIGX is also strongly activated by rifampicin. And SIGY does not appear to be. So I basically knew at this point that I was going to look at L, M, and Y exposed to both the rifampicin and the MPA, because I knew that the rifampicin wouldn't be causing any activation I might see. The MPA would have to be causing it.
Do you think you get more statistics even M and Y?
It's possible that M is slightly on. Y looks slightly off, if anything.
L
could also be slightly on, yes, but basically I only have one test, so. this is the SIGW strain I was talking about, and strong bimodality. This is just an overlay of the red and the yellow channels, and you can see that it's pretty clearly on or off. Maybe this guy's the only guy who exhibits some sort of in-between state. Yes?
Again, this is not degradable, right? So you
don't know it's on,
it's only that it has...
Yes, Fabio, yes. As I said at the start, I just took snapshots. I already confessed that. I don't have movies. But Okay, so yeah, you're right. It's possible that during the 24 hours these guys were exposed, that they only had a chance to pulse once. But honestly, in my opinion, given that the duration of the pulses is about an hour, the degradation time is, I don't know, it's a few hours, but it's certainly less than 24 hours. I would say, just from dilution, it's less than 24 hours. This is exhibiting pretty strong bimodality.
I mean, I think the main point is that the effect of the fluorescent protein being stable, if anything, will smear out and weaken bimodality. So if you see something very strong in a stable quarter, it's even stronger.
So I can't remember what SIGW is responsible for, but it seems to be quite stressed when the polymerase is being inhibited.
It's interesting, actually.
So as you from the graph above, what was it, L, M, and Y showed that they were most like weren't affected by rifampicin. So I took the cases where they were exposed to a small amount of rifampicin and a small amount of MPA, plated them out, and looked at their fluorescence again. Yes, they may have been activated at some point during 24-hour process. And here I have the reverse cumulative distributions of their fluorescences. So the black lines, the blue lines were basically the histograms you just saw, but transformed into this format. So you can see there's quite broad fluorescence, not that much activation between, not a very wide distribution, certainly no long tail. Then black is the case where I expose them to MPA by themselves, no rifampicin, and you can see the long tail emerges, certainly in certainly in L and Y, it's got a long tail, not so much in M. I think that's maybe like one or two cells in the long tail at the bottom. So then the red line is telling you what happens when you expose them to rifampicin and MPA, and I think in pretty much all the cases, you can see that the long tail is being suppressed pretty strongly. Maybe there's a little bit of strong activation here and a little bit down there, but the general effect seems to be that there's no guys who are strongly switching on. So what does this mean? Well, we're messing up with polymerases, so. You might expect that the amplitude of any pulses that might have existed during the time of exposure was really suppressed in the first place. It might be that they're struggling to express anything, including the YFP itself. Although the blue line sort of indicates that they can quite happily express when there's just rifampicin. So
the rightmost is actually W, not M, right?
Y.
Y.
L, M, and Y. Yeah.
Do you know what rifampicin does it still leave the polymerase intact so that you can have something like an inhibitory competitor? Where it just sucks up.
That's what Andrew would be useful. I can't remember if it does a corrupting influence, if it's a corrupting influence or a blocking influence.
I mean, I'm not so sure it blocks sigma factor binding. I'm not sure that's the
problem. I'm not sure whether it stops the polymerase from transcribing or whether it makes it transcribe but it has huge error rates. I can't remember
it stops it from transcribing.
Stops it.
It blocks it, but the question is, if it's still in the soup, you're essentially adding things that can't do anything but sigma factors can still bind to. So effectively, as far as the sigma factors are concerned, we don't know they've lost polymerase.
But if the sigma factor, part of the pulsing loop is the fact that the sigma factor binds the polymerase and transcribes itself.
There's one key biochemical detail that might affect this interpretation, which is that the sigma factor is present in the RNA polymerase complex during transcription initiation, and then the standard view is that the sigma factor gets ejected while the polymerase continues to transcribe. So, if rifampicin is slowing transcription rates mostly after the ejection of the sigma factor, it may have less of an effect, let's say, on
you mean the sigma factors will still be able to initiate transcription as frequently as they were before?
Yeah,
but I think the fact remains that the pulse is suppressed because if you're transcribing yourself slower as a result of this drug, you're not going to get. I mean, it's hard to tell from this, other than I can say that we haven't got pulses of this. Either we've suppressed the frequency or the amplitude or both of the pulses. So either I haven't seen pulses because they're infrequent or because they're really weak. That's all I can say from this, I think.
How much MPA did you add here? So presumably this is a good concentration.
This is 20 micrograms, well. So it's not good, but it's not slaughtering them horribly. But there were very, like, the cell concentration was very low. So there's some useful information, certainly in the rifampicin exposure there. So it's something that I rushed at the last minute, so don't expect too much. Anyway.
The curious thing is getting MPA seems to suppress these things, right?
I would say that the background level of fluorescence is lower in MPA, but it's higher in the long tail. So I guess without MPA, you're sort of fluctuating in the middle, and with MPA, you become a sort of suppressed, but when you're on, you're really switched on, which is useful, I guess, for the purposes of looking for pulses, because they're going to be much more obvious.
Saying is it's very weird to have something, one thing activates, the other thing activates, you put them together, and there's no effect.
Right.
That's suppression.
Mm-hmm. You mean like the fact that the red lines are also quite suppressed?
Individually, they activate different ways, either homogeneously or heterogeneously. Mm-hmm. But put them together, and then they don't seem to activate.
Yeah. Well, it's like I said, that means we're either not observing the pulses because they're infrequent or because they're weak. And that's, I don't know which of those is true, but clearly, if the pulses were infrequent but strong, they'd have a long tail. And if the pulses were frequent but weak, then the buildup of the YFP might also show fairly broad, strong fluorescence. But I don't see either of those things, so I think that they're just not really happening. Okay, so I did work on something else with Ignacio, who's going to show you that we finally got the mud machine to work.
Summarize the last 2 weeks in 2 slides, just briefly to give you an idea about what we've been doing with this mother machine and why it could be useful for studying these sigma factors. So you're probably all familiar by now with this device, which was developed a number of years ago in the lab of Chun, which is now UCSD. The idea is that you want to trap cells, either E. coli or, for instance, Bacillus subtilis, into these microchannels, and you are then able to follow the divisions of the mother cell and see sort of how it's aging over time. And you know, you can then track along this lineage. You're essentially staying on this side making sure that you always know which are the daughter cells of the mother, and you can sometimes also follow them a little bit further down the channel. And anything that goes outside, we just assume it's dead. So the idea is then that you can have whichever markers you like and follow the dynamics of expression of the promoter activities over time. So that's one of the things we've been trying to do with one of the simplest single reporter strains, the Sigma B strain with an MPA energy stress. This device is just a schematic taken from this paper, which is, I believe is also from the same lab. There have been some tweaks to this original design but since then. This is more or less like the one we've used because we don't really allow very good diffusion, and you'll see this in the movies, in and out of the channel of nutrients. So we actually observe quite a bit of cell death at the end of the channels. So the workarounds that is, if you probably saw the presentation by Thomas Norman, involve just having a, like a lower plateau where you can have some inflow of nutrients coming from the main channel. So here you have flow of media with the drug at a rate of 1 mL/h. And for around 20 hours, this was probably in the fifth attempt, or maybe even more than that. Okay, so I'll just show you how it looks. So actually, I realized a second ago that the film's not show well here. So I'll just show you an image, Jay. So we have the face, and then mCherry is the same constitutive marker that you've seen in the rest of the film. And the YFP here is just it is a reporter for the sigma B activity. So let me see if I can find it. So I should have actually done the merge version of this, but you can see how that looks. So you can see, for instance, in this channel here, there's quite a bit of cell death. You also saw some monster of a bacterium just popping out. And after around 20 hours, we lost focus because the tubes leaked out. But it seems to be going working reasonably well. I think probably the major optimization that needs to be done to this design is allowing for better diffusion within the channels.
Yeah, by the end of the
evening,
you can see the tops of the channels basically. Dead, yeah. So you don't think they're getting enough nutrients. Yeah,
right.
Can you just do shorter channels? That's probably what you're well. I mean,
sure.
You only, some people, like, you should only have a look at the cell at the top of the channel anyway, because that's the one you can track the whole time.
Exactly.
But other people, like, on Goldman's device, have a really, really long channel, so you can get intermediate to stick
mm-hmm.
nice
in the back. So I mean, here it's if you try and track the lineages, it becomes quite difficult because you lose a mother cell in multiple of these. But we got quite kind of good filling rates of all these channels in different, you know, all the way across. We tested various widths, and we went through various implementations where you could fit two of these guys side by side. And then so if you now look,
I think we get about 6 or 7 generations out of it, which isn't too bad.
Yeah.
The idea is trying to get more generations than you can observe on any of that, which initially is about 6 or 7.
So
how did you get them into the channels?
So to get them into the channels, first you have to passivate the device with this magic mixture, that includes salmon sperm, which is still something that puzzles me. But yeah, okay, so one, there's one other thing that you have to do. You actually, well, I we've tried both strains that have chemotaxis and some that don't have chemotaxis that have that knocked out. And you see a bit too much swimming if you have a chemotactically moving strain. So, anyway, the interesting one is the one here, which
yes.
is the one where you're wanting to see some.
You have to grow up a reasonable dense culture, then you spin them down. Your mixture that you're pumping into this is like a sort of very creamy cell.
It's very, very dense, yeah.
Soup. Mm-hmm. So I think in the most, we didn't take an image of the culture then, but like, basically, once you put them in, you leave them for an hour or more, at 37, you hope they swim in. There's also a little bit of diffusion in from you moving stuff around, so you get much more food.
There's no need for spinning.
You look at it before you clear the channels, unmask yourselves.
Sure, but I think in many of the other protocols, they actually needed spinning to get them in, and we didn't really need it, which was nice. Because you can break the device quite easily. But okay, so here what we're trying to see is whether there's any heterogeneity in the levels of expression and whether you have sort of dilution of the protein levels of this YFP after division between the mother and daughter cells. So these films, I managed to segment based on the mCherry channel. Unfortunately, all of those I have in the computer over in the lab, but I can show you some of that stuff later if you want. And the tracking did work to some extent. You're able to see some interesting things, like for instance, you can see cycles of kind of filamentation and like changes in cell length. If you track cell length over time, for instance, you can see when they sometimes get like a bunch of them get detached, and then you have a sort of a huge reduction in the amount of material that you're detecting in each of these channels. It's very difficult to say for now whether we observe any pulses of a given duration or so per given channel, because correcting for the background or so hasn't been that trivial. But I'll give it a go maybe this afternoon.
You can see pretty strong switch on events. I think sure. About 2-3 hours in, they kind of all get a bit brighter.
That's right. It seems to be associated with cell division, doesn't it? The brightest ones are growing cells, yeah. And then it fades out when they're less.
Yeah, you have cells that are also growing and not pulsing along. Yeah, there are definitely some that divide.
So, like these guys, for instance, right?
Switch on, like,
actually, the second from the right, you did lots of that example there. Yeah. Where they're growing very well and not pulsing, and then they pulse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I think that's it for now. Joe?
Okay. That's great.
So, yeah, it worked.
So I chose to look at the model, the simulation for the sigma factor dynamics. This model and simulation weren't created by me, but they were created by people in my colleagues' group. And I wanted to look at the simulation and try to understand what form time sharing takes in the simulation. We talked about two different possibilities. One is that the pulses actually share in time, so there's a single or a couple pulses at every single time slice. Or alternatively, that maybe the amplitude of each pulse decreases, the all equal amplitude. And that's how the polymerase level is shared. So just to go back and reiterate this point, there's a polymerase, a bunch of sigma factors. They need to share the polymerase in order to transcribe more sigma factors. So these sigma factor pulses are due to these sort of positive feedback cycles that come in. I'll show a picture in a second. And the idea, right, is because there's limited polymerase and these things are competing, they have to share the polymerase in some way.
Are they all equally stable, the sigma factors?
In the simulation?
No.
In
real life. In
real life. Yeah. In real life, I don't think we know the protein stability of the sigma factors, but I think the key thing here is that they're regulated predominantly by anti-sigma factors. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of post-translational regulatory mechanism. But there are examples of some sigma factors that are, or there's many examples where there's regulation through the stability of the anti-sigma factor, or through degradation of the anti-sigma factor.
And I'll talk more about that in the next slide, exactly the mechanism that's in the simulation model. Right, so these pictures are outlined from Michael's papers. But you get plots like this from the simulation. So this is actually produced from the simulation. And each of the different colors is a different sigma factor. And you know, you look at it and you say, okay, well, when these things are clustered together, they have small amplitudes, and when they're not as clustered, they have large amplitudes, and there's not too many overlapping, and there's some stuff going on down here. Maybe that's other sigma factors that are being suppressed that are trying to pulse. So what I want to do is try to understand pictures like this.
The doubling time of the bacillus?
Yes. what is it, like 60 minutes?
In conditions, we usually look, it's around 2 hours.
2 hours.
Okay, so this is the proposed sort of genetic circuit that's going on here. Sigma factors are around, they're sequestered by these anti-sigma factors. If something comes along and removes some of these anti-sigma factors from the picture, there's more sigma factors, they bind to the polymerase, they get brought down here, they transcribe more sigma factors as well as anti-sigma factors. This is a positive feedback circle, so the sigma factor levels spike, and then once the anti-sigma factors catch up, they sequester all the sigma factors, and the sigma factor production ends, kills the feedback cycle. And so this is built in,
So is this now the model, or is it the real system?
Well, this is the model.
The model, okay.
I don't know enough of if this is well established, that this is really what's going on.
This is a model, but the idea of the model is to focus on features that were common to basically all of these sigma factor regulation systems. And so the features that are common are the autoregulation and having the sigma factor and the anti-sigma factor together in the same operon, and the sharing or competing for core polymerase. Those are the key elements of the model.
And the way the sharing is implemented is every single sigma factor is basically identical, except this thing called sigma A, which I'm just going to ignore for now. And then they're coupled by the total polymerase. Okay, and so the way this model is implemented, these not too important to real details here. The idea is that these are basic equations for reaction rates. So the degradation of chemical species is just the product of the, or it's just a proportional to the concentration, and production of things like anti-sigma factor, sigma factor complexes are just proportional to the product of the concentration. So it's a very standard, simple set of equations, although you have a lot of equations, and they're all coupled. So that makes it very difficult to analyze analytically.
Yeah. Quick clarification for you, so are the values for the different parameters from actual experimental data?
So that is something I'm not entirely sure about.
They were chosen to be not as such. I guess they're chosen to be plausible, and also they were tuned a little bit to get the system into a regime in which we had interesting behavior that was double boost.
But yeah, the point of this also is not that you can't read these, but there's a lot of parameters. There's a lot of parameters in this model, so that's what that illustrates. So what I'm going to do is I'm basically not, you know, there's lots of different regimes these dynamics can, the system can be in, and it'll exhibit different dynamics. I'm going to stick basically with all these, assume they're right, and just change one other parameter and see how things like time sharing behave or emerge. Okay, so this is a plot that I made from the simulation that's very similar to the one we saw a couple slides ago. It's just the overall sigma concentration as a function of time, and again, you get some sort of clusters of things. Sometimes there's pulses that have smaller amplitudes. Maybe these are being suppressed because the purple one came in first. And there's some stuff happening at low concentrations. The difficult part is the way this is, that there's sort of an artificial element to the simulation. And I didn't mention it, but it's down here. What removes the anti-sigma factors from the picture are these ligands that come in. And the way they're implemented is ligand pulses come in randomly in time with some distribution of spikes in the concentration. So, you know, maybe there's some sort of noise in the system and this is actually what's occurring. But each of these ligands is associated with anti-sigma factor, which is associated with the sigma factor. So if you really want to understand how something like time sharing emerges, you have to not just look at this picture, but you have to look at what the ligand pulses are doing. Okay? And when you look at that, things, the idea that time sharing is happening in this picture kind of fades away, because you can see that every single one of these pulses is associated with the ligand pulse. The temporal sort of correlations are just the correlations here. And the heights are pretty well correlated as well. So you can actually demonstrate that. Here's the ligand pulse initiation times and sigma pulse initiation times. They're perfectly correlated. And the heights are fairly well correlated. So you don't want to fool yourself when you're looking at this stuff. So what I decided to do is just look at
first of all, ligand concentration spikes that are all at equal heights, and then have some random temporal elements, as well as looking at trains of ligand spikes that have different periods. Because I want to disentangle the effects from just this, which is really simple, just the way you drive the system, from the other more complicated effects where the polymerase is being shared and therefore other things emerge. Okay, so
Just on the previous slide, the signal that you're plotting is the RNA polymerase complex?
No, this is the free signal.
That's free signal.
So the RNA polymerase complex and the free sigma are really strongly correlated. The pulse shapes are slightly different. But when you have a big sigma pulse, you have a big RNA sigma pulse as well.
And the ligand makes the anti.
The ligand comes in, and very quickly it sequesters a large amount of anti-sigma back.
Yeah. I mean, so, maybe that's what I'm saying. The purpose of the ligand is to inject kind of stochastic initiation events. It's just a way to kind of inject noise
right
into the system in a way that's independent for each of the sigma factors.
But you want to be, my point is just to say that you want to be careful if you're going to say something is emerging, like we want to call it time sharing, or you say some sort of competition is causing some sort of, you could imagine that, there were seven ligand pulses in this period of time, but then these two got very large, they used up all the free polymerase, there was no more free polymerase for the other five, and so you don't see those.
Yeah, it seems like the regime here is relatively sparse in time, right?
It is, you have very few sigma pulses even near each other. There's a couple of examples.
So you're going to go to other regimes.
Yeah, right. Okay. So the point is to push into other regimes. Okay. So that things are so that ligand pulses are very much clustered, so that you can see something like time sharing emerge if it doesn't even emerge from a simulation like this.
Really, I think maybe you want to think about the ligands of doing the rate system, just giving us some stress.
Right. That's a whole other issue. What's actually going on if this model captures that?
Right. Yeah. Well, I would say that the spikes of these ligands are not representative of what's happening. If you're under stress, you don't suddenly see a whole ton of stress and then it goes away again. You see a background level of fluctuating stress, right?
So the dynamics wouldn't be that different if you didn't have ligand pulses, but you had step functions in ligand concentration. Mm-hmm. The initiation of the sigma pulse is due to the pulsing of the ligand, but the termination of the sigma pulse is due to other internal dynamics.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out here that what's really happening is you get a step up, the ligands step up in a single discrete event, and then they're just diluted out, so there's no fast degradation of this fictitious ligand. It's just diluted out. It looks like a big spike here because the time scale is very long, but
The decay time
steps, and it's really the initial edge, the step up in ligand that drives the dynamics of the sigma factor.
Right, so what I wanted to do is I wanted to just, here I put in the, here I put in the ligand pulses, they come in this distribution in time, but they all have the same height, and you can see that basically the sigma pulses, again they have the same distribution in time. So the ligand pulses, the height is not exactly the same. So this is actually interesting. You can see that the heights are almost always the same. But when the pulses come close to each other, the second pulse, the following pulse, is often a little bit shorter. I actually found this surprising. I mean, it makes sense that there's less polymerase around, so the next pulse can't reach a high concentration. But I thought the effect would be much stronger, especially when you look at the free polymerase plot here. So if you look at this example here, we have a blue pulse and a green pulse. As soon as the blue pulse comes in, the free polymerase level basically drops. You can understand the free polymerase as it tries to stay at some constant equilibrium value up here. Every time a ligand pulse comes in, it drops it down to some very low level, and then there's some quick recovery time for it to reemerge to the equilibrium value, and as another ligand pulse comes in, it keeps driving it down. So after the first pulse, this is almost always true, after the first pulse, you deplete almost all of your free polymerase. The next pulse comes in, it gets to almost the same height. So the question is, what's going on? Where is it getting the polymerase from? And if you look at the polymerase sigma complex concentration, you get a hint as to the answer. So these lines, they're thick because these are the sort of slightly fluctuating, more or less steady state values of the other sigma factors that aren't being activated at this time. These are the ones that are pulsing from the ligands, these are the other ones. And you see that all of the other polymerase sigma concentrations dip when one of the pulses comes in. So what's happening is the pulse is taking the free polymerase, and once it runs out of that, it's taking polymerase from the polymerase sigma complex. And so because you have this pool of not unactivated sigmas and polymerase sitting around that you can draw from, unless you have a lot of pulses, the system is more robust to depletions and polymerase than I initially would have imagined.
Basically what you're saying is that even though the level of the unactivated sigma polymerase complex is low on a per sigma factor basis, right, the fact that there are many of those different species means that in some they provide a kind of reservoir that can be utilized to initiate a new pulse going on.
Exactly. So this suggests that if you're going to see time sharing, you need to push it into a almost all the sigma factors are activated, because then there's a very small pool. Okay, and then what else? Okay, so still, you know, then it's pretty high, just looking at these two pictures, but still the temporal correlation is great. So it affects the heights when you put them in like this, but it's still the case that every ligand pulse produces a sigma pulse at some fixed delay. Okay. So what I did next is I said, let's just put a train of ligand pulses in that are pretty close to each other and forget about the stochasticity and time. And I put the ligand pulses in so they're spaced closely relative to the period of the signal pulses. So what do you see? You see that all the signal pulses have the same amplitude. All that happens is the amplitude of all of them decreases. When you look at this plot, though, this plot isn't too surprising. I mean, I have basically symmetry in time and the driving force, and every single sigma factor is identical in the model. So the only possible result is that you have overlapping pulses that look identical. So maybe this isn't the best thing to look at. Maybe it's better to look at, you know, it's not actually true that this is deterministic stochastic. So maybe it's best to look at, you wait a long time, have no ligands come in, and then start a train of ligands coming in and see how the system reacts to that. That way you don't have this time symmetry and you don't get just this pretty boring GA and the sigma factor pulses. But you can see here that they're sharing. If they are sharing, they are sharing in amplitude, they're not sharing in temporal. They very much overlap. And
Wait, John, how much time? Just your time.
I'm almost done. I just want to show two more plots that are like this. Here's another one where you have no pulses up until everything settled down to equilibrium values, and then you put in a train of pulses, and you see basically the same thing. The free polymerase drops, but it drops in very small amounts. There wasn't much free polymerase to begin with because there were so many sigma factors, and the polymerase is bounded from these complexes. But what's interesting is I would have expected from this that the first one would be bigger, and then the next one would be a little bit smaller, then smaller and smaller and smaller. I think what's happening here is the first one starts to get big, and the second one comes in, and since there's no free polymerase, it has to draw its polymerase from the sigma anti-sigma of the activated one, so that decreases the height of the first pulse and increases the height of the second pulse. And so they're able to share the polymerase through this polymerase sigma complex very nicely, and you get very similar looking pulses, and they are all decreased in amplitude, but they're not sharing in time. And then I did one more thing. I did the same thing, but I really increased the frequency of ligand pulses, and you have tons of them overlapping. I mean, there's like 60 sigma factors here, and in the period of one sigma factor, all of them at some point get activated, and you still see the same thing. That they share in amplitude, but they don't share in time. So I think there's evidence experimentally that they're sharing in time. So I think either there's other regimes that I haven't explored in this, maybe the parameters of the original model that that I showed on the first slide are not quite correct,
or maybe there's something else we need. And I think that the way the ligand pulses come in and deplete this anti-sigma factors is kind of, it's not very realistic. So it's likely that you can put something else in and then you can get more time sharing dynamics. This model, I don't think, at least I haven't found a parameter regime where you really demonstrate time sharing with this simulation.
So this, like, this is all due basically to the input signal. The input signal is not, I mean, you need to find an input signal that correctly possibly produces time sharing.
Right. I mean, you can do it sort of trivially where you just make the input signal very widely spaced so that the pulses never overlap. But I think you want something more interesting. Yeah.
I think the issue here is really, like, when you're driving at really high frequencies like this, uh-huh. you're essentially kind of pushing it into a more or less continuous behavior, right?
Right, well, that's why I showed the initiation of this thing, because you get this transient thing. This is not so different than if you had stochastic ligand pulses coming in and you looked right after just some atypically large gap followed by a train of tight pulses.
But I guess the part that's a little confusing to me is it doesn't seem realistic to expect even the biological system to respond at this time scale. Right, so I don't understand. Even if you found the right parameters,
why do you say that?
Because I don't think the diffusion and the kinetics are set up in a way that this would work. Right, because what will happen then is you crush the polymerase concentration. It's exactly what you're fearing. Because I think there's an inherent time delay in the actual transcription and buildup of your own thing. And if your pulses precede that, even in the actual system, it's going to just crush it.
Yeah,
that's my impression. I think it is.
I mean, if you saw the other plots when they were
pulses with my hand.
When they're well separated, you do see, the first pulse is a little bit bigger than the second pulse. When they're more well separated, when they're very well separated, the pulses are identical because the polymerase has time to recover. When they're more closely separated, you do see some effect of the first one and the second one. And when they're really close together, I agree with you that it sort of drives into this equilibrium state and you see all the pulses.
I guess one thing I should point out is that I think one thing we did with the parameters that I think you're starting with is you're starting with parameters that were actually chosen not to show the anti-correlation because, and I think we talked about that, because we didn't want to claim anti-correlation because it wasn't experimentally observed. And so the idea of this parameter regime was simply to show that you could get a regime where these ligand pulses can initiate a stereotype sigma factor pulse and that the sigma factor pulses can be distributed in time enough.
Well, by increasing the ligand pulsing, I'm putting it into the regime where they really are strongly competing. So that's what I've changed.
They're distributed in time because your ligand pulse is distributed in time. That's the problem.
Let's try to reach some wonderful conclusion.
Yeah. Well, this is the end. So.
I think we should, as a group, also just thank Adam and Jin because they really were kind of like heroes on the whole thing. Yeah.
And thank you guys because I think we have like tons and tons of interesting stuff to pursue with this. So it's amazing. Yeah.